Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hot water.
We need to talk about the threat of the women's liberation movement. So let me be clear. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. What I am against is a small elitist group putting down homemakers. They want to create a sex-neutral society, which will mean that women are going to find themselves with two full-time jobs. So you need to tell your senators you want them to vote no on this Equal Rights Amendment so we can have a country that we are proud to leave our daughters.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Mrs. America. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're a little confused, this is the couple weeks of overlap where we are covering both Westworld and Mrs. America. So, if you came here for robots, stay for fembots. I don't know. Like, come join us, Westworld fans, as we discuss, this great FX on Hulu show. Today we will be talking about episode 5. Which is titled, let me get the order right, Phyllis and Fred and Brenda and Mark. And so we will be discussing that episode this week on the podcast. We also have a very special guest, our token male guest of the season, John Slattery, is here to talk about, Fred Schlafly. So that is what we are up to today. If you are just joining us for the first time ever, what Still Watching, does is every week, Richard and I pick a show. Well, we commit for a season of a show that we are sort of watching and obsessing over. We break it down episode by episode. So right now, here we are. It's Mrs. America Westworld season. and we're here to discuss all that. Richard, before we get into like the meat of the episode, I just wanted like your broader takes. How does this episode stack up to the first four in your view?
I like it. I think it had a certain, the narrative structure I thought was really good. And I think that it thematically, the two kind of storylines, I mean, I guess Steinem was in there too, but like they really linked up together well. And then I think they kind of added, kind of temporal benefit that in 1974, in March of 1974, Free to Be You and Me was airing as a TV special. Mm-hmm. And that just added such a nice kind of wistful, ironic button to the episode. So yeah, I thought this episode felt to me in its craft the most like an episode of Mad Men, which, yes, I mean is a compliment.
Yeah. That ability to fold in a pop cultural event and make the themes of it so resonant with the personal story that's being told, right? Like,
yeah, and it didn't feel forced. It felt like everything, you know, comparing Brenda's marital issues with Phyllis is like, it all felt of a piece. So I like that the through line was really clear in this episode.
I completely agree. All right. So I also wanted to let you all know that if you wanted to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, we would love to hear your thoughts. We've gotten a couple emails so far. This one comes from Jim. And Jim writes in to say, I know it's difficult for stories to be told that are multi-layered while effectively addressing intersectionality and the micro-level aspects of public policy without getting into the weeds. This could only be done on a long-form episodic style. I'm frustrated, however, that the hateful monster Schlafly, whom I remember as a true enemy, is shown triumphantly building her coalition, racist and sexist as it was, while the feminist movement is displayed with all their conflicts. But then I guess that's what makes good drama. I just hope that the direction shows how effectively diverse feminist ideals have become embedded into our greater society. Excellent podcast, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you, Jim. I think, you know, that's something that we will continue to discuss. I think that's been the main sort of question around this series is like, is Mrs. America too, I don't know, kind to Phyllis Schlafly or, you know, elevating to her or that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, having seen the arc of the whole show, I don't think that that's going to be something that people will reasonably be able to argue by the end. But I also just think even now, you know, this is not a particularly victorious episode for her. And I think, you know, I think showing her struggles doesn't make me understanding where her, where a lot of her stuff comes from doesn't make me like her anymore. What do you think, Richard?
Well, I think it grants her the humanity to make decisions. It's just that she makes all the wrong ones, you know?
Right.
I think, I don't doubt that Phyllis Schlafly had a mix of disgust and compassion for her son, who she recognized as being gay. And I think we can, you know, that is a relatable human moment as she's struggling to navigate that. But in the end, her, the worst of her politics wins out and she gives him this hideous speech about not being gay, being akin to quitting smoking. Right. So I think that we're getting a full psychological portrait of her. But it's not letting her off the hook for anything. You know, and I think that is a risk. Anytime we, you know, attempt to take a more in-depth look at a sort of noted villain, are we then just by showing, you know, their sort of interior life, are we somehow condoning it or complicit in it? You know, the spread of that ideology. I don't think so. In this show's case, I think Blanchett and the writers and the directors know what they're doing. And I think this episode really, in its emotional clarity really shows you that like, she wasn't just an abject, you know, evil entity. And that's what makes her more scary and more frustrating is that she was a person who had these kind of wishes and regrets and all these things. And every step of the way basically subverted, sublimated all of that just to kind of win on purity points, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, the humanistic portrait of a figure like that, I don't know. I think about this in terms of, what happened after the 2016 election and how much harder it became for me to, even harder it became for me to relate to like Republicans I know. Because if they voted for Trump, I'm just sort of like, I don't know how to communicate with you, a Trump voter. And so then for a while, I just sort of like boxed everyone I knew who voted for Trump, like into a sort of like unreasonable, probably not worth my time sort of column, which is not something I'm comfortable with. And I think, you know, just boxing someone off, is Phyllis Schlafly a monster? In many ways, yes, absolutely. Maybe in almost every way. But I really love what you said right at the jump there, Richard, which is just that it affords her, this depiction of her affords her the humanity to make decisions, right? And I think trying to understand that, not sympathize with or agree with in any way, but trying to understand that is, I think, worth doing. Understanding the origin of something is a good way to figure out how to fight it, right? Or, you know, anyway, that's my take on it. I understand that it's still sort of like a rough spot for some people. And I'll be very curious to see how people react to this particular episode, which, you know, as I said, cannot be really considered a victory for Phyllis, though she does, I decide to go to law school. So there's that. All right. So let's run down really quickly the new characters we meet in this episode before we sort of get into all of it. So we had already met, Brenda Feigenfausto, played by Aria Grainer. She had been in some earlier episodes, but this is sort of, you know, spotlight has moved on her. And then, we get, her husband, Mark Feigenfausto. How do you feel about Adam Brody's, 70s hair in this episode, Richard?
I feel good about Adam Brody's everything.
Yeah.
you know, I feel like some new unknown piece of the puzzle just snapped into place now that Adam Brody and Cate Blanchett have been on screen together. Like, it feels like two cultural interests finally united. Yeah, and I didn't know that he was going to be in this, so that was kind of a pleasant surprise.
So there's that couple, and then, you know, Frank Thomas is the name of the man who Gloria is dating for most of this episode. He had been in earlier episodes as well. He's played by Insecure's Jay Ellis. This is a real life figure that Gloria called, you know, as late as I think it was like 2015, called like the love of her life, her best friend sort of stuff. But also in this episode, Gloria meets Stan Pottinger, played by Jake Lacy, America's boyfriend, Jake Lacy. And she, Gloria Steinem, wound up dating that guy for 8 or 9 years, I think, into the 80s. So this is like a crossroads of two relationships, major relationships in Gloria Steinem's life. So yeah, I think this is the most, men in any episode of Mrs. America. Mark Feigenfausto is a really interesting figure because, you know, this episode, you know, we hear about the book that he's writing, The Male Machine. We hear about, you know, the men's liberation sort of stuff. But, you know, she, at the time, right now, I don't think we think that much about people barreling their names, but they met at Harvard Law School. She married him. She hyphenated her name, and then he hyphenated his name.
Yeah, it just made me think, growing up in Boston, there was one neighborhood in particular, Jamaica Plain, that was, a largely Latino neighborhood on one side, but also on another side, a lot of kind of ex-hip or current hippies who moved there in the 70s and early 80s. And, all their kids were, you know, about my age, and I went to school with a lot of them, and almost to a person, they all had hyphenated last names. you know. And as their parents did, you know, so it was very, in vogue, I guess, at the time.
Yeah. It's just funny. Like I grew up, you know, in Northern California. My mom kept her maiden name. It was her second marriage. She kept her maiden name, Williams, and, still has it. Right. And everyone just thought it was, I just remember everyone thinking it was so strange that, you know, my mom's last name wasn't my last name, and were my parents divorced and all stuff like that. I'm like, no, they're still married. She just kept her name. So, you know, I guess where I was growing up, which I thought was like super liberal and progressive, like was still catching up, to what was going on. But we used to joke because, you know, my last name's Robinson. We used to joke that my mom didn't want to be Mrs. Robinson because of the Simon and Garfunkel song, but I don't think that's, so anyway, so Brenda Feigenfausto, is a really interesting figure. You know, she's like a co-founder of Ms. Magazine. There's a really brief mention in here when, Fred Schlafly is sort of, dismissing her as, you know, a nobody. And Phyllis says, well, no, she wrote this amicus brief. And the amicus brief was for a case. Let me look it up. I have it right here. It's Frontiero versus Richardson, 1973 case. And that established, that people in the military, that the military could not discriminate, benefits based on gender, in the military. And, what's true of Brenda Feigenfausto is she had a really close relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like they were good friends and worked on things together and stuff like that. So, if you saw the documentary, RBG, Brenda was interviewed for that. So you would see her there. But yeah, I mean, so this is a really interesting, you know, I mentioned earlier that Davi Weller had said that, you know, this season of television was sort of about the times in which the Schlafly movement and the feminist movement, the places in which they sort of like intersect and overlapped. And so here we have another one, which is the Feig and Faustos debating the Schlaflys on Tom Snyder's show. This actually happened in 1974. So this idea of, I just think it's such an interesting opportunity for the exploration of who they represent. Like Bella sort of opportunistically thinks of them as this like golden, attractive couple who can sort of put one kind of face on the feminist movement. And then the truth that this episode posits that lies beneath.
Well, yeah, I mean, this episode is really adept at showing the compromise positions that both women are, Brenda and Phyllis, are in. You know, Phyllis is in that position more kind of her own making in a way. But both of them are subject to different versions or different degrees of a certain kind of expectation, that, you know, can be imposed on them, not just, you know, by themselves or by their immediate people, but like, you know, in various ways, that feel kind of contrary to the way they've organized their lives, you know? So I thought that was an interesting parallel to see that, in both storylines, let's just say, for example, that Phyllis, you know, with her son realizing that he's gay, and Brenda maybe realizing that she at least has, at least this version of Brenda has some version of, you know, same-sex attraction that she wants to act on. Both of those in their own weird ways run sort of completely counter to, what they've created themselves in terms of branding and identity. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it shows that like one kind of irregularity, if you want to call it that, can disrupt an entire, self-conception or ideology, which just goes further to show that, the best way forward through all this is not on Phyllis's side, obviously she would disagree, but like on Brenda's side of things is that sort of more, that broader intersectionality, and to open it up to, as many, you know, kind of ally and compassionate voices as you can and experiences, because, there's no accounting for all of the variants that might exist, you know? So I like that kind of internal struggle, if you want to call it a struggle, kind of standing in for a bigger thing about the size and shape of the feminist movement's tent, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting because, we talked before about sort of the Gloria versus Betty dynamic of last week, and this sort of like what the feminist movement looks like or is allowed to look like, and the, what Gloria Steinem represented by being sort of beautiful and glamorous in terms of making sure that the feminists were not written off as just, you know, disgruntled, unattractive, women. And, I was reading up on some like, Brendan Feig and Fausto, articles that came out at the time. And there's this can I read you one of my favorite, lead paragraphs of all time of a profile I've ever read? This journalist is named Philip Nobile, and this profile of Brenda, this interview with Brenda, was sort of syndicated in a bunch of different papers. But the first paragraph goes, if I were an incorrigible male chauvinist, I would describe Brenda Feig and Fausto as a gorgeous and leggy blonde lawyer, although she fits the aforesaid description quite nicely. Ray's consciousness forbids my making any big deal out of her appearance. There are more pressing matters, like the lowly station of women in the eyes of the law. So, that's just a really neat writing trick of like, I mean, I'm not going to say this, but I would say this. But. Yeah. You know, if I were a knuckle dragger, I would say this, but I wouldn't. Anyway, so
well,
that's
it's very like yeah. People are saying. Yeah, I'm not saying it, but people are saying.
My friends say. Yeah. So that's you know, Brenda in her own way and in a much lower profile way than Gloria was, you know, sort of one of these like, you know, attractive, married sort of faces of the movement. And there's this part right at the end, right, where Gloria is talking to Brenda, you know, over dishes or whatever, about like, you know, like do you think you are gay? Like, should we, you know, do we want to talk about it? Like, what's going on? And, this version of Brenda has this quick line about, like, where's Kate Millett now? And Kate Millett was this, member of the feminist movement, second wave feminist movement, who came out as lesbian slash bisexual and was sort of, like she said she was lesbian, then she clarified that she was bisexual, she was married to a man, whatever. But in any case, she said that in, I think it was like 1970 or 1971, and it put the brakes on her prominence. And so that reference is meant to say, like, if I come out as gay, I, Brenda, might lose my high profile status as a member of this movement. So that was my interpretation of that name drop of Kate Millett there. But, and the way in which that dovetails with Margaret leaving for Oakland, because this character of Margaret, once again, a real woman who worked at Ms. Magazine and is leaving, and, you know, has this sort of exit interview with Gloria while Gloria's, boyfriend and his two kids are right outside the office. And Gloria says, like, oh, she's leaving because, like, the schools are better in Oakland. He's like, oh, is that why? You know, and, like, part of that is, you know, some of the stuff we had seen Margaret go through at Ms., when it comes to, like, you know, black women and tokenism, but also, like, I have to imagine her queer identity as well. So, you know, that being part of it.
Well, yeah. And I think you see, this debate ever, you know, ongoing. I mean, look at, you know, with the fight for, let's say, gay marriage, which was kind of meant to be a stand in for all encompassing equality, you know, for LGBTQ people. And yet a lot of time the criticism was that the face of the movement being put forward was very safe and very sanitized, very white, very affluent, and thus really left a lot of people behind or ignored in the pursuit of something that was supposed to be good for everybody. Right. It's an age-old debate. I appreciate that this show handles it not as an afterthought, but as an actual, like, part of the text of this story. You know, I wish that it had the time to follow her to Oakland, you know,
yeah,
and to figure out what that all was about and what she found. And, you know, because there's a lot there that is worth unpacking, but I guess, you know, they are limited somewhat by the constraints of time and whatnot. But, yeah, I think they've done a really good job of not, you know, just as we kind of talk about the humanization of Phyllis Schlafly, they've done a really good job also not to, you know, make this a hagiography about Gloria Steinem or any of the others. You know, they are shown as sort of flawed and, yeah, self-interested people.
Right. Exactly. So we open the episode with an avant-garde, performance. It's just like amazing, puppetry of the penis, situation here. I loved this. Did you enjoy this, Richard?
Yeah, it made me think about, like Lysistrata, you know, the Greek comedy, where, you know, thousands of years ago, it involved, like, people running around with big fake erections. You know, it felt very, definitely like the theater of the moment, kind of almost like agitprop-y, overly stylized kind of thing. And it's just kind of, in its own way, though, kind of quaint that, that could ever be viewed as, like, terribly avant-garde or shocking.
Right. What I did love, though, is there's some shots in this episode. You know, the whole series so far has been really well directed, I think, but this episode was directed by Laure de Clermont-Tonnerre. So hopefully I did not butcher that French name. But there is a shot in this scene where, you know, the the fake male genitalia and the fake female genitalia are sort of like bashing together in the foreground, and Brenda and Mark are framed behind it, and the chant of the avant-garde theater is like, this is what a marriage is, this is what a marriage is, this is what a marriage is. And like, rewatching this episode, having knowing the journey that Brenda goes on in this episode, I just thought that that framing was really clever. There's another shot too, you know, we're in the office where Fred is being interviewed for his profile. It ends right before we cut to credits. It ends with Phyllis just sort of idly tipping her fingers on the scales of like a little statue of Lady Justice or whatever. And I'm just like, it's almost too much, but it's not. It's not too much. It works for me. Did that, I don't know if you like saw that shot or if it worked for you or not.
I didn't see that particular shot, but yeah, again, I think with all of this kind of stuff, like I think that this episode really weaves its kind of thematic stuff together quite nicely and tightly, you know. And I don't know, I feel like we really got a sense of just the kind of mood of that time and of you know, for that particular kind of group of, you know, urban sophisticates. You know, it all felt very correct, I guess, even though I wasn't there then.
The part where Fred is getting interviewed, this is a real, I found the article. This is a real life article. The headline really was Phyllis Schlafly's lawyer husband against abortion and communism. And the photo really does have like her photo framed behind him over his shoulder, like the whole thing. And the whole thing is like very much about her. And you know, and we're meant to take this as like an emasculating moment for Fred, that he's being sort of outshone by his wife, but that she's trying to play it where, you know, because she's so smart and knows how he would react to that, she is trying to play it like, oh no, it's not about me, you know, like sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I just think the journey that Fred goes on this episode, while not sympathetic, is also interesting, very interesting to watch.
Well, yeah, because, you know, again, he's not shown as some hectoring ogre, you know, who, you know, chains her to the stove or whatever. You know, he's proud of her and he, quote unquote, lets her do things. You know, he clearly married an intellectual person, or at least an, you know, educated person. And yet you see the limits of it come out in a sort of petulance and then a kind of outright anger, all while claiming that he's doing it, you know, sort of in support of her. It just feels like a very realistic portrait of, you know, in its own, what is in its own way a sort of abuse. You know, it's not, he's not gaslighting her exactly, but he is making her think the parameters of her life are a little wider than ultimately he wants them to be or will, quote unquote, allow them to be.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me, so the debate, the big moment of the debate, not to hop around too much, but the big moment of the debate is when Fred calls her submissive, right? And that is taken actually from a 1978 Good Morning America interview that you can watch. You can go on YouTube and watch right now if you want to, if you're inclined to watch footage of the Schlafly's on Good Morning America. But he said that. And her reaction isn't quite as sort of Cate Blanchett plays it a little bigger than the real, like, Phyllis actually sort of played it. But it's word for word. And this idea that's also covered in that interview is you know, he's like, well, she has her thing, but she never really tries to get into like my thing, which is law. And Phyllis says the same thing. She's like, we just don't really like compete on that level. Like, that's just not something that we compete on. So understanding that that is Fred's psychology, that like, as long as he has his law career, he has this thing that Phyllis doesn't have. Her taking the LSAT and wanting to go to law school, and him knowing that it's not just sort of like idle whatever that she did that, it helps explain why he would sort of humiliate her in that way, in the debate, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, that's an interesting scene because I didn't necessarily read it as deliberate humiliation in retaliation for something. I read it as really the unpalatable truth of their side of things having to be said out loud and them realizing, both of them, how actually fucked up it is, you know? And they obviously don't self-assess enough to not continue to advocate for those things. But in the context of being on a television show, you know, sitting across from this like much more progressive, young, you know, attractive couple, and Phyllis being completely embarrassed about making up a legal case, and then saying, oh, right, at root, I guess we're saying that she's submissive to her husband, or to me, I guess that's what this is about. And they're kind of like surprised about it. I think indicated some, you know, an interesting thing about what the show is arguing, particularly about Phyllis Schlafly, is that it's not entirely clear where her belief stops and where her ambition carries it forward. You know, I don't want to conflate a woman's ambition with something bad. It's not. It's just, you know, I think this show is just still kind of trying to figure out how intense her motivation was ideologically and how intense it was just in terms of, I want to like lead something and do something significant.
Yeah. And I think that that's the ongoing question. Like, how much does Phyllis believe any of this? And in what way is she grasping for power or significance, or the spotlight in some way?
Yeah. And you see it like with the brief scene with Melanie Lynskey's character and Sarah Paulson's character, where Lynskey comes in with a megaphone and is like, abort the ERA or whatever. And Paulson's like, oh, I don't know if that's really where we want to go. I think that sometimes the extremity of what these, you know, what people are actually fighting for almost escape, you know, they can kind of sublimate it and put it into their subconscious. And then when they're confronted with the actual verbiage, with the actual implications of, you know, this thing, even they are a little startled by its intensity and what it's actually saying, you know, and what its actual intent is.
Yeah, we've seen those moments of discomfort before too, when like Phyllis is forced, you know, like forced to acknowledge the various compromises she's making. And I don't think she gets a pass on those compromises, ideological compromises, but I think it's worth considering that she didn't do it, you know, gleefully, maybe, you know, potentially. I feel like this is a good spot to just drop in on our conversation with John Slattery about Fred Schlafly and sort of his take on, you know, what made their relationship work and what didn't.
It's obviously kind of a peripheral part of the story, Fred Schlafly. So, I just thought it was a great story that I wanted to be involved in. I was pleased at the way that everyone sort of prized every relationship in the story. You know, I knew it certainly wasn't a story about Fred Schlafly, but I never felt in any way shortchanged, you know, about time and detail and consideration and support and all that. So it was really, I had a great time doing it.
I was just watching, you know, before I called you, I was just watching that Good Morning in America interview from 78 that Fred and Phyllis gave, part of which was lifted and put into this episode. That part where he talks about her being submissive. I'm curious what it's like for you as a performer to have, you know, if you watch that video, and what it's like for you as a performer to have video that you can refer to see how this man said those things on air when he did, you know?
You know, I know you hear stories about people playing actual people and it's daunting and you don't want it to be an impersonation. But there really isn't that much video or archival footage of Fred Schlafly. So it was really helpful, actually. A couple of times, a couple of different moments that I talked to I can't remember her name, who wrote the Daughter of the Silent, Darling of the Silent Majority, which was one of the texts that I was given. And she knew Fred and interviewed Phyllis a bunch of times and told me what it was like to encounter Fred and spend time with him. And then watching the little bits of footage that I was given were really helpful. Because they sort of, Davi and her writers had to cook up kind of a backstage narrative that arrived on stage in that moment, with her wanting to go to law school and her kind of fighting Fred and his desire to have, you know, his traditional family structure, not be upset by Phyllis's agenda. And so it was really helpful to kind of, I don't know, guess maybe, or just try to reverse engineer how he arrived at that moment and why he chose to say that in that particular way. And, you know, and then when we did it, like you said, they lifted it and put it into the Tom Snyder interview. So it was a different context. We were facing off against the other couple. And it was just like a lot, where to look and when and how to sort of best express the knowledge of what Fred was saying and when versus, you know, what Phyllis was doing in the moment. And it was that particular interview was a different kind of thing where they just kind of ran roughshod over the whole thing, like in you know, Brenda and I forget her husband's name.
Oh, Mark.
Mark. You know, I think, I don't know whether it was their debating technique or whatever, but once, you know, Tom asked the first question of Fred and Phyllis, they just kind of blasted through a bunch of facts. So it was, I guess the answer is, it was really helpful in kind of choreographing where and how Fred said what he said.
Yeah, it's interesting to me to watch that interview, that Good Morning America interview, and try to understand this relationship better, try to understand their connection. He talks about sort of the way that he met her was, you know, he read an article, thought it was written by a man, and wanted to meet that man, and it turned out to be Phyllis. So it's a, you know, an intellectual connection as much as anything else. You know, how did that inform the way you and Kate crafted this relationship on screen?
That scene was in the show for a while, and then got cut for time, as were a few other scenes. You know, when I first met Kate and Davi, well, Davi I had known, but when we first got together to rehearse, it was clear that all the material that was at our disposal was to be considered in play. So there was what was written, but it was never suggested that something else couldn't be added or this point needed to be made clearer. So the relationship, I found it interesting that given the public platforms of all these people, that the backstage repercussions, the personal repercussions of all these relationships, and probably selfishly because that's where Fred's scenes kind of take place, being that she's the public figure in the relationship. And I just was interested in preserving and highlighting the personal repercussions for particularly Phyllis, but all of these women and the repercussions to their agendas, their egos, the time spent striving to get the positioning that they deserved, but that they had to struggle for. And all of that, as I said before, was thoroughly considered. So truly all you can ask for is willing partners and an ability to sort of pipe in at any time and and arrive at a place through rehearsal where you feel confident that this is the best version of the scene to show the relationship that you're trying to show. And I really felt that the time was well spent.
Was there ever a moment, a scene, a conversation you had with Kate or with Davi that really gave you felt like was an aha, eureka, I understand this man or I understand this relationship and I know how to attack this?
I mean, it really did grow. I mean, the Kate and my knowledge of each other and how we worked and how open and willing, you know, it takes a little while to get used to working with someone and their rhythms. And so while we were comfortable right away, I feel like, speaking for myself anyway, it takes a little while to go, all right, if I do this, that's something that someone's going to get without me having to explain it beforehand. I'm just going to wait till they turn the camera on. I'm going to try this and see how that goes. And then, you know, you cut and then you go back and go, all right, that worked. Let's try that again, but let's not take so much time doing this or that. So it was a constant series of adjustments to get and make clear each little moment. Because I feel like with Fred and Phyllis, that's what they were. They were little moments of back and forth, give and take, as far as, and it was a lot of negotiating. And a lot of times Fred thought he was going to come out on top of that negotiation and didn't. And so, you know, you sort of have to show the attack, the execution, and then the aftermath of a moment or of an argument or of a negotiation or of a debate that they would have, an intellectual debate. They were on the same side of a lot of these issues, but Phyllis was clearly suited for the public side of this relationship. And Fred would have to have been a fool not to recognize that. And he was not a public person. And he wasn't very comfortable on camera as referenced by those bits of footage in those interviews. So
yeah.
I don't think they were pitted against each other in that so much. I think there was a power struggle in the family and certainly later on in the show where she decides to go to law school and that's his one, as one of their children said, that was his one place where he felt like, this is my arena. You can have politics and right. You can have the organizing, but leave me this. And she chose to go to law school anyway, as we see. So, I mean, I guess it was just a series of adjustments. There wasn't really a eureka moment in one scene where I thought, oh, this is who Fred is. I guess we got closer and closer, and sometimes, you know, you never know, like, what the real, you know, behind closed doors in their bedroom, what Fred and Phyllis were actually like beyond a couple of anecdotes here and there. So you're making a lot of it up. And the more time you spend with each other as characters, as actors, the more the subtle parts of the communication kind of open up. And I feel like that happened all the time from the beginning to the end.
It's interesting. There's a really uncomfortable scene early on, which I think is reflective of this quote that Phyllis Schlafly gave, famously said something along the lines of, there's no such thing as sexual assault in a marriage. You know, if you're in a marriage, mm-hmm. You have agreed to this. And then you have this really uncomfortable scene where Fred is pressing, his affections on her and she clearly doesn't want it. You know, and so that is one of those made up moments behind closed doors in the bedroom that informs this relationship. But, you know, mm-hmm. Fred is such an interesting, form of, like, I don't know if abuser is even the word you want to use, but this sort of paternalistic, controlling, yet sometimes supportive in a way that's almost more insidious than if he were an outright, you know, abusive husband.
Yeah.
What's your take on that, on walking that line with this character?
That was a scene that was, I mean, it was an assault. So there's so many terms of sort of sexual assault thrown around, but it was clear that she wasn't happy to be involved in it, and Fred was going to get what he wanted. And so it was very delicate, the discussions in between takes, how violent the actual action of the scene is can be without it turning into a date rape scene, which mm-hmm. is then, are you alleging that this is what took place? You know what I mean? It's sort of like we're sort of making this scene up. So how far can you go without being irresponsible? And it was, so it was that kind of a scene. I mean, it's not a pleasant scene to shoot, obviously. I just remember being so present in, and feeling like everyone was in the execution of that scene, because it is again a nonverbal transaction that Fred and certainly Phyllis are aware that they want two different things, and one of them is going to get what they want. And so it was a subtly complicated scene. Well, not even that subtle, because, you know, again, it's this sort of nonverbal negotiation, and it's difficult to execute that without it, because there's so many ways it can get away from you. Is that help? I mean, I'm just trying to remember the actual doing of it, and it was a bit of a high wire act, that scene, because, you know, you don't want it to fall into a scene about a rape, because that isn't the story you're trying to tell. You're trying to tell the story of that Fred wants what he wants. He wants her to stay home. He wants her to be this traditional wife. He wants to be, maintain the role he feels like he plays in the family. And she's doing what she wants. So I guess it's a scene about retribution. It's a scene about, at least from Fred's standpoint, him communicating to her that this is the way this show runs. And it's really ugly, that scene.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting to me, the way you describe shooting it, I speaking to a lot of the women who worked on the show, they talked about what a rare circumstance it was for them to work on a show with so many women. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the converse is true, is was this a rare experience to work on a show, you know, as a minority, and the cast is a male minority in the project? And
yeah, I mean, certainly I was, there were not a lot of men around, on at least as acting partners. I grew up in a house with four sisters, and I mean, I grew up with a lot of women.
Right.
So it was never uncomfortable. I knew what story I was getting involved in. I knew that this was a story about all these women and produced by and directed by predominantly women. Funny, maybe this is a difference, but I never felt any power struggles. I felt like people were exhausted as you get. This is a giant production. There were something like 400 speaking parts, people flying in from all over the place. I'm just trying to think of a contrasting production where there were more men than women and what that was like. And I don't know, not surprisingly, I feel like all those women produced the show incredibly well.
And I guess, yeah, on a more personal level, having watched her work on Mad Men and then do this, what is it like to see Davi go from, you know, producer, writer on Mad Men to, you know, runner of the show in this instance?
I directed at least one episode that Davi was the writer on. You know, given the pressures that must have been there, because they are, if you're a showrunner, everybody needs something from you every minute of every day, not to mention having written it and having to make sure that the story is, you know, and it's always moving because you run out of time in one episode, you have to tack something onto something else to get the story, you know, to make sure that a moment in episode one reflects, you know, or lands in episode nine, or, you know, the sort of overview of it is always in the back of your head. And she was always so generous with her time. And we have a really friendly rapport from having worked together before. But she's just fantastic and remarkably sunny, given what I'm sure were pressures from all sides. But again, I think it was so well, when I first was sent, I don't know, the first four of them, I was really impressed with how, given the scope of the story and the sweep of the, you know, the 10 years of the, you know, the subject of the story, how many of the details she was able to weave in, personal and professional details of all of these characters, you know, nothing seemed to suffer. And it's of a certain style. It's not a documentary. It's stylized. It's funny. It's witty. It's emotional. And it's all, I was remarkably, in a remarkably economical way. And yet every time I'd bump into her, she was great. She was just fun to see and talk to. So, you know, I had a great time from, I guess I said, beginning to end.
You mentioned, growing up with in a house full of sisters and, you know, this decade of history covers your personal teenage years. How aware were you of this fight of the women's liberation movement, of everything that was going on this front in the '70s?
Probably not that aware. I knew who Phyllis was. I think I heard Stacy say she would confuse her with Anita Bryant. And I probably was more aware of who Anita Bryant was just because she was a little, I don't know, more mainstream or commercial.
And I've been asking, you know, your female co-stars this, but I'm curious your answer. Why do you think this fight for the ERA matters, and does it still matter? You know, there's a question, you know, among some people, even liberal-minded people, who are saying, well, the ERA at this point is redundant, or, you know, et cetera. There's all these arguments.
Yeah, I think it matters. I think it matters. It mattered then, certainly. And even though it's been overlapped by other parts of the Constitution, or at least arguably where, you know, everybody legally should be treated equally, I think it's there are inequities and there are in every part of society. And I think that anytime you can make it clear and add it to the framework of what this country's about as plainly as it should be, and so that there's no backslide, because I mean, look where we are, you know. So some things you take for granted and all of a sudden change is afoot, and the different leadership, different administrations, and all of a sudden things that, you know, as you take for granted aren't there anymore. So yeah, I think it's important. I mean, I don't know. I thought it had passed. I think like other people,
<too. laughs>
I'm like, oh
yeah.
And now it seems like a no brainer, but no, I think I do think it's important. Yeah.
On that Good Morning America interview, Fred Schlafly was asked if he was a feminist, and he said no. But I'm wondering, you know, what you think about that, about his, you know, there are certainly men in this world who wouldn't have let their wives do what Phyllis Schlafly did at that time.
I think that Fred was a feminist. I mean, I think Fred, you know, Phyllis. Are you going to allow Phyllis to do what she does, or you married this woman? I mean, like you said, you know, he walked into this bank thinking that a guy wrote that article, and he encountered Phyllis and was enamored of her for a lot of reasons, her intellect probably being the first reason. And so how do you stop a woman like Phyllis from being who she is? I think he recognized who she was, and they saw eye to eye on a lot of the issues. So I think his reticence to admit that he was a feminist had to do with the traditional role in Alton, Illinois, and his practice, and the nature of a conservative lifestyle in the Midwest at that time. So I think it was mostly about appearances, but I would say that Fred was a feminist, because, I mean, I think, well, at least in the case of Phyllis, did, I mean, I'm not sure he believed that women were men's equals, but I'm pretty certain that he thought Phyllis was at least his equal.
And that's such an interesting thing. It feels like that was almost Phyllis's perspective too. She's like, you know, no, women should not be ambitious outside the home except for me, because I'm special and I should be allowed to do this. But women in general, that's not their place. And I think that's a fascinating contradiction within her, you know. I'm sure you're aware of this, that there is a Fred Schlafly Award, from the Eagle Forum, about what it means to be a supportive husband.
I wonder who else has won that award.
I'd be very curious to know.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
So we should talk about, this struggle that Brenda is going through in this episode. And I just want to be completely forthright and say that, I spent some time trying to, I always try to look at what is real and what is invention in a show like this. And there's so much meticulous real detail in this episode, in terms of timelines and headlines and all that sort of stuff. And what is true about, Mark and Brenda is that they did divorce they did have a child together, Alexis. They did divorce, in the late 70s, early 80s, depending on who you ask. And what is also true about Brenda is that, she's worked a lot recently in her law career on, issues surrounding same-sex marriage. She attended the 2013 Supreme Court hearings in the DOMA and Prop 8 cases, but I could not find any confirmation that, she was either a lesbian or bisexual. I can't find it. And it might be out there, but I haven't been able to find it. So I don't know how much of this, I know a lot of the personal details of, people's lives in the show are somewhat invented. I don't know how invented this is. But we need to talk about, a main through line of this episode is that Brenda meets this photographer, Jules, played by Roberta Colindres, who Richard recognized from the musical Fun Home and I recognized from the TV show Vida. And she's great. She brings this really great energy, into the room here. But they have this affair and, Brenda is very, I think Brenda's conflict over it and then Mark's conflict over it and how it's not what you expect, but still, tough to watch. I think is, a really interesting story to watch play out.
Well, right, because it's, again, it's a nice parallel to the stuff with the Schlafly's, which is, yes, the parameters of your life are very big, and we are thinking in, very progressive terms, and, of course, everything, we have an equal partnership, all this, but then actually, in truth of, at least in this version of this relationship, not everything is okay, and there are some kind of stuffier, sort of more traditional things guarding it, guiding it or influencing it. You know, I think that the crucial thing where he's like, if it had been another with another man, that would have been a much bigger thing. And it's like, but why? You know,
right.
And then he kind of belittles the experience by saying it's like a rite of passage for any women's liver. Not that it might actually have been like an actual expression of self, you know? So I think that I don't think that this episode is coming down on heterosexual marriage as an inherently faulty, you know, arrangement. I'm coming down on it that way, but. But I think what they're really nicely showing and insightfully showing, is how pervasive, patriarchy in its many forms could be, you know, that a woman as educated and as free thinking and all that as Brenda, could have denied a part of herself for so long and, you know, so thoroughly that it so surprised her, is a really, you know, kind of shattering sort of idea. And also, you know, we have all the stuff with Phyllis's son, who is clearly reaching out to a desired life in his own way, a much more furtive and arguably dangerous way. And yeah, it just, you know, there's a lot of loneliness in this episode. And I think it's important to see that in addition to all the sort of, you know, rallying and unity.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely want to get to John Schlafly. I think that you know, this character and this depiction is really, you would ask me a couple episodes ago, like, I know that John Schlafly is a gay man. I don't know whether or not the season's going to deal with it. And I promised you that it would, and it will continue to. And I think that is a really important and interesting internal contradiction in Phyllis Schlafly to pursue. But I wanted to really quickly get into this like men's liberation movement that Mark was a part of, a vanguard of, I guess. So I just want to like touch on a few things that I found that I thought were so interesting. First, there's this article from 1972 called Teen Talk. It's basically like an advice column. Where this woman wrote in, I want to go to law school, then devote all my efforts to the women's liberation movement. However, I also want to marry. My question is one I've never seen answered. How do men feel about wives who are involved in the women's lib? And this person, this columnist responded like, a great response about how like Betty Friedan's husband was not supportive. She says, Mark Fausto, husband of lawyer Brenda Feigen Fausto of the National Women's Political Caucus, said, quote, too many men want their wives to make them feel superior, but my life does not depend on my subordinating Brenda. I take great pride in her accomplishments. And the column also quotes, Martin Abzug, who's Bella Abzug's husband, who we'll also meet. This parade through the husbands of the women's liberation movement or the partners, is really interesting to me. Is, you know, this is a show about women and I don't want to center it on the men, but to me, they show up in this, like, you know, for an episode in the same way that, like, I feel like sometimes the wives on Mad Men did, you know what I mean? It's like a nice little flip where they'll just like show up and they'll be played by an actor that you really like and then they'll just go away. I think of like, Trudy on Mad Men or something like that. So, I just think that's interesting. And so Mark wrote this book, The Male Machine. And there's this really interesting article over on Vice, called The Men's Liberation Movement, Time Forgot. It's from last year, March 2019. And the subhead is, nowadays the men's right movement runs the gamut from incels to red pillars. But in the 1970s, men's libbers look something like feminists, ? It's a great sort of examination of this. Cause if you say men's movement or men's liberation movement, I shudder and I think of that Parks and Recreation quotes when she's just like, men's rights don't exist, like it's garbage or like whatever. So, this idea that this was an earnest and, well-considered sort of movement at the time, the Male Machine, I was reading a little bit of it and it is interesting because it is extremely progressive and also in obviously into 2020 perspective, feels regressive, as well, because there are just limitations onto what Mark could conceive of for equality. You know what I mean? It's so equal in his mind. But then he says stuff. He's got this quote where he goes, he being like the male machine, all men, he has armor plating, which is virtually impregnable. His circuits are never scrambled or overrun by irrelevant personal signals. He dominates and outperforms his fellows, although with excessive flashing of lights or clashing of gears. His relationship with other male machines is one of respect, but not intimacy. It is difficult for him to connect his internal circuits to those of others. In fact, his internal circuitry is something of a mystery to him and is maintained primarily by humans of the opposite sex. So this idea that like women have to like allow, help men access their emotionality and stuff like that. And it's like, is that true? Can be, but it's a very limiting perspective, obviously.
Well, right. I mean, it shows how there can be gender essentialism even on the progressive side of things, you
right,
know?
Right.
This inherent, this suggestion or this belief that there is something inherently male about anybody or inherently female about somebody, you know, is something that got baked in, I think, to this movement that has been really hard now, to take out, when you start to widen the tent again to trans people, particularly, you see what's happening with a lot of British feminists who, have become, I mean, TERFs, really. And it's, you know, so I think it's, I wish that, you know, I wish again the show had time to go into all of this, but, I appreciate your research at least, even if, we don't get it on the show.
So let's talk about John Schlafly. The actor here is Ben Rosenfield, who I know best from, his work on Boardwalk Empire.
Same.
But he's a tremendous actor. I've always loved, he's just like a very subtle actor. And there are moments throughout, you know, and like, Fred attacks John a bit at the dinner table and Phyllis like sort of jumps to defend him, or she is sort of nudging him to maybe study for the LSATs or something like that. But of course, like the big scene is this final scene between them at the piano, where, as you say, she gives him this disgusting speech, but then they both like tearfully play the piano. It's such a spectrum of emotion, to go through in a relatively short scene. How did all of that work for you?
Yeah, I think it's a really well done scene. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we have a lot happening in this episode. That's the Schlafly boys having these kind of expectations put on them, you know, go to law school, go into business, maybe go to medical school, you know, all these things that they are supposed to do to assume their rightly male place in the world as men of, you know, power and privilege. Mm-hmm. But of course, this was not a household that was, you know, this wasn't a fundamentalist household. They were allowed to pursue other things, it seems, because we have John playing, you know, the piano beautifully, as an expression of creativity. And, you know, that is oftentimes associated with effeminacy or being gay or whatever. So it's just, I think it's an interesting example of someone finding the little egresses in the confines of their life, you know, that he could be as gay as filled the house and then no more, you know. I think that that's a really interesting portraiture. I think that the as creepy as it is, the monologue that Cate Blanchett delivers about the quitting smoking, is a really good example of something that seems that was probably intended as loving. And yet what it's actually saying is, you know, tantamount to, torture yourself, or else, you know, you're going to harm yourself. And I think that that's, well, it's obviously a dichotomy that it's not solvable, you know, harm yourself so you don't cause yourself any harm. Right. I think it accomplishes a lot in one scene, which is, you know, if efficiency is the name of the game and something that's covering a lot of lives and a lot of time, I think this is well done.
Yeah. There is, you know, you mentioned earlier that these are creatures, motivated by self-interest. And I think, you know, there's this question of like, you need to be more careful is something she says to him, and is something that the guy who, you know, brings back his wallet and basically extorts some money from Phyllis, says as well. It should be more careful. But because of the way that that sort of extortion scene plays out, it doesn't feel like Phyllis is saying, like, you need to be more careful for your own safety. Cause it feels to me like she's, I mean, I'm sure that's on her mind, but it's also like, you need to be more careful because of my reputation also, or our reputation.
Do you know? Oh, yeah. No, the careful there is not, I don't think, really about his safety or anything. I think, yeah, it's about, you have to be more discreet, really.
Right.
You know, or try to avoid it all told, you know.
But discreet for his sake or discreet for her sake, you know what I mean? And I think it's
for the family's sake. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it also, the way that she, you know, understands and from a, you know, with her nose held from a distance, accepts that he has had at least one dalliance with a man, is felt in a way like this woman being like, well, you know, men have their needs. I wish he didn't have this need and that he would be more, you know, careful about it, but more discreet about it. It still links into, this gender dynamic that, is clearly toxic to all of them. And yet, you know, it's not seen that way.
Yeah, the culmination of the Fred and Phyllis fight in the hotel room after the debate, where she slaps herself. You know, I think that is extremely interesting in terms of, you know, Fred Schlafly was, by some weird standard, an oddly supportive husband for, you know, given their politics and their, you know, points of view in the world. And this point that Brenda makes that Phyllis isn't a housewife. She's a full-time lobbyist. You know, one of many excellent points that Brenda scores in that debate. So the fact that Phyllis has had to internalize that, you know, Fred's not going to be physically abusive to her, so she slaps herself, is a really powerful, quick moment in the episode, I think. And we should talk really quickly about the debate. So, Bobby Cannavale is here, Rose Byrne's, partner, playing Tom Snyder and, doing a fine job. And, I really love the pre-debate scene, the backstage moment when the Fred and Mark and Brenda are all bonding about Harvard and Phyllis is like the odd man out of this foursome. And I liked this idea that of course, like Phyllis and Fred would try to like make polite small talk or like, do you know so-and-so? I know so-and-so with the Feig and Faustos. That of course that's something that they would do and how much that backfires on Phyllis, you know?
Yeah. I think, you know, just seeing that, the sort of the social rules that they have carefully, the Schlafly's have carefully lived by of decorum and this kind of thing. Isn't going to work in the same way in that new era and with a sort of different thinking kind of people. You know, and I think that clearly she goes on stage thinking that this is going to be go one way. And then Brenda just does not relent on trying to get some facts, you know, some actual, cases cited or whatever. And it's just, it seems like Schlafly is so helpless in the face of someone who does not kind of, you know, demure to, convention or social tact or whatever. And I think that, it will be interesting to see her kind of harden against that and figure out how to conquer, that sort of innate, like, politeness, I guess, because what she's doing is very impolite. She's just doing it in a kind of shrouded way, you know?
Absolutely. The debate is fascinating. The Brenda and Mark sort of like railroad the Schlafly's, or I should just say like Brenda does it, like, cause Mark just sits there. Mark gives the, like a textbook perfect, answer to who wears the pants in the family. I just want to like applaud this fictional version of Mark for his great answer for that. And we see that Gloria is watching the debate, having slept with this new guy that she's met. And this is a betrayal because, you know, her partner, Frank, at least this version of him in an earlier scene, it said, like, I wouldn't be okay with that. So, like, you know, yes, Gloria was like a freewheeling, like, I'm, you know, Sex and the Single Girl sort of like, attitude. But, you know, if she has some kind of covenant with Frank, at least this version of Frank, she has betrayed it by having, this dalliance with this person. So, and, you know, I think that shines through in her discomfort at being like asked to be a godparent to Brenda and Mark's baby. Cause she's just sort of like, you know, that I think feels like more, of a like conventional couple ask than Gloria is comfortable with. I was reading this, there's a Vanity Fair profile actually of Gloria Steinem that was, written in, I want to say 2012 thereabouts, where they interviewed the guy, the real life guy who Jake Lacy is playing. And, he talks about in that article, he talked about how, Gloria didn't want kids because she had to take care of her mom. Like, her mom was very sick and had to take care of her mom. And so he's just like, yeah, she didn't want kids and she didn't want to get married. She just wanted to like live her life, and how challenging that was for even other members of the feminist movement to understand.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting, Gloria plays a really interesting role in this episode, where she seems a little bit aloof, a little bit kind of, you know, not sure of her place in the movement. And I think maybe like getting a little sick of not looking out for herself, I guess. You know, cause I'm sure that Heavy, you know, sits the crown that, you know, where you have to kind of be this representative of this big thing all the time. And then perhaps seeing that Brenda could not only kind of do that interview, but also sexually explore, also be pregnant at the same time and all that, you know, not that those are things necessarily that Steinem wanted, but like, the sort of more holistic experience of being alive, I think you see that kind of become appealing to Steinem, at the end of the episode where she's like, I'm going to retreat and do a little, I want to do my own writing, you know? And I think it's a subtle kind of shift, I think, in the character, but I think Byrne really plays it well.
And this ongoing, like, I want to write my book. I want to write my book. Oh my God, this guy Mark is writing a book before me. So I'm like, and I do want to say of Mark's book, The Mail Machine, almost as big as his own name on the front cover as Gloria Steinem's cover. It's like forward by Gloria Steinem. And like, you know, so she's doing him a huge favor by writing this intro for his book. But lastly, Though I don't want to close out this episode without noting that at one point Cate Blanchett says, thank you, Daddy, to John Slattery. Like, I mean, and in that way, you know, I'm like, I'm not on Fred Schlafly's side really at all, but like the fact that she's like on her knees rubbing his legs and says, thank you, Daddy. You know, if that's to be believed as true, then him later saying she's submissive, I was like, well, I mean, I don't think she actually is, but she's playing the part to get what she needs. So let's talk about Free to Be You and Me really quickly. So this came out in 1974, I believe. Did you have this album in your house growing up?
I did not, no.
Mm-mm. Okay. We did. My sister was born in 77, so I think, like, closer to when this came out. And so it was, like, more my sister's thing than it was my thing. But, like, I have all the songs from Free to Be You and Me memorized. It was just, like, a huge thing. And Marlo Thomas, you know, we just talked about Mary Tyler Moore last week. Marlo Thomas was sort of – she has been not as well remembered as Mary Tyler Moore. But her series, I think it was called The Single Girl, or That Girl. Yeah, That Girl. And it was just sort of like another one of those, like, you know, single girl in the 60s sort of, you know, taking on the world, sort of thing. And Marlo Thomas did, along with Gloria Steinem, help found the Ms. Foundation for Women. So that, that album, you know, which was enormously popular. The proceeds did go to the Miss Foundation, which I just think is interesting. And so, you know, like, you don't really need to know that much more about Free to Me, You and Me, other than the, like, main song, which plays over the end, which is, of course, crushingly ironic, as Brenda is sort of sitting there feeling like she's not free to be the person that she actually is, accepting for at least a time in her life, this marriage, this motherhood, this role, you know?
Yeah, sorry. I don't, I think I have to go because of this stupid fucking delivery. I really, really liked that closing shot. I think it really, yeah. You know, I like that it made these four people just four people who were sitting on a couch, you know, having a glass of wine, mm-hmm. watching something that a lot of other people were watching. Like it grounded it a bit while also speaking to the mood at the time. I mean, you know, that special could air in 1974, which was really about trying to level gender differences and all that. There was stuff happening beyond just these people, you know, they were obviously huge parts of it, but, I think it just really nicely set the time and place, while acting as a very bitterly ironic button for this particular episode, which saw at least two characters realize that, in fact, no, they are not free necessarily to be themselves. At least if they want to, continue playing by the rules of the various social contracts that they signed, either willingly or not.
Excellent. So that is episode 5, Phyllis and Fred and Brenda and Mark. We'll be back next week with an episode titled, Jill, and we'll be chatting with, the great Elizabeth Banks about that. Jill is my favorite episode, I think.
Ooh, I haven't seen it yet. I'm excited.
Of the whole season, because Jill Ruckelshaus is, you know, sort of the token Republican, and I think it's a really interesting look at the Republican Party at the time and what it was going through. Also, I won't spoil for you who the, like, husband guest star is next week, but it's pretty exciting. So anyway, until then, Richard, where can folks find you?
Well, I've got to update all my Adam Brody fanfic, now that he and Blanchett are scene partners. So I'll be busy doing that from the safety and of my home, tweeting at Ryla's and writing it on VF.com. Joanna, what will you be doing until next week?
I will be seeking out that tremendous This Is What a Marriage Is, avant-garde puppetry of the penis performance.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know.
I think it was a kind of mid-career Neil Simon, right?
And memorizing it. Otherwise, you can find me on VanityFair.com or on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Richard and I will be talking about something else from the 70s this week, 1975's film Network. Over on Little Gold Men. So it is a mid-70s week for us, podcasting wise, and we'll be back for the Westworld finale and then Jill next week. See you then.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.